man who uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. It is the last day of the week, the day that we always, in the first hour of our program, check in with Congressman Bernie Sanders, our Brunch with Bernie segment. Congressman Bernie Sanders, the only member of Congress who is neither Republican nor Democrat. He is an independent, the only independent member of Congress, the longest serving independent member of Congress in the history of that institution. He's been reelected seven times now. It's seven, right, Bernie?
Re-elected seven, serving eight.
That's serving into your eight. That's absolutely remarkable. Our telephone number, if you'd like to speak with Congressman Sanders, 1-866-889-8894. From outside the United States, 503-248-0620. Our chat room is at tomhartman.com, our live chat room. And I guess that's all the housekeeping. Bernie.gov. House.Bernie.gov, the website, and Bernie.org, your two websites. So, Congressman Bernie Sanders, I noticed in the New York Times this morning an article about how the ACLU is all upset because the FBI is now using a Section 215 demand of the Patriot Act to get records from a library, which the ACLU can't reveal the identity of because of the Patriot Act.
Yeah, well, it never ends. The good news here, Tom, is that the House of Representatives passed legislation that I introduce, which would exempt bookstores and libraries from Section 215 so that the FBI or any other government agency couldn't go on a just walk into a library without probable cause. The bad news is that the House leadership refused to put the provisions that we passed into the Patriot Act. But the Senate has a lot better language. But I think this article and the fact that the FBI is now using Section 215 will make it easier for us to pass the Senate provisions, which at least demand that the FBI have an explanation as to why they want to go into a library or a bookstore. But I think all over America there is growing concerns about civil liberties in this country and the Bush administration's use of 9/11 as a way to get around our U.S. Constitution. Terrorism is serious business. I've said this a million times. We saw what happened in London not so long ago. It could happen in America again. But what we have got to do is protect the American people through vigorous, well-funded, well-trained law enforcement. We want them to investigate terrorism, but we have to do it in a way that does not undermine those qualities which make us a free country. And I think the Bush administration does not understand that.
Yeah, the Fourth Amendment is pretty unambiguous, that you have to have a probable cause, that you have to have, you know, to produce a warrant by a judge. That is an agency, the judiciary, independent of the executive branch,
right,
in this case.
And that is not what 215 is about. Essentially, despite what the Justice Department says, all that the FBI has got to say is that they're doing an investigation on international terrorism, which they do all of the time. And if they say that, the judge has got to let them get into an individual's reading records and without explaining why they think that person is involved in terrorism. And that is undermining the constitutional rights of the American people. So, yeah, we're going to fight terrorism. We're going to protect the American people. But we can do it in a way which maintains our freedoms.
Yeah. Now, oil prices and gasoline prices, this is something that is of particular concern right now, in particular to people who drive a lot and to many of our truckers who are listening on Sirius. But also, as winter is coming, I think people in the Northeast, well, all across the northern tier of the United States, it's going to become a real serious problem for families on fixed incomes.
Tom, you know, I was thinking, it wasn't so long ago before Tom DeLay and the Republican leadership in the House decided that the entire Congress had to reconvene, we were on break, in order to deal with the Terry Schiavo case. Do you remember that?
Oh, yes.
That was just the most important thing, that we had to override a decision by a court in Florida dealing with the very painful problems, choices that one family had to make. Meanwhile, in America today, you have millions and millions of people who are seeing large chunks of their paychecks going to the oil companies. People in the Northeast and throughout the northern tier of this country are scared to death, elderly people on fixed incomes. What is going to happen when winter comes and they can't afford to heat their homes? The president has inadequately funded the federal fuel assistance program, LIHEAP, so that fewer people are going to be able to take advantage of the program, or they'll get smaller amounts of assistance. Now, one would think that if they could reconvene Congress to address the Terry Schiavo case, that maybe Tom DeLay and the leadership of the Republican Party in Congress, the President of the United States, might sit down and say two things. Number one, we have a national emergency costing working people in this country billions of dollars, threatening the health of elderly people who can't afford high fuel costs. We are going to sit down and we're going to address the problem. We're going to lower fuel cost in America. And second of all, we're going to move this country away from fossil fuels, from our dependency on Middle East oil, make our nation, both transportation, otherwise, much more energy efficient. Now, if they could focus all of their attention on Terry Schiavo, do you think that they may be able to focus their attention on a problem facing tens of millions of Americans?
Somehow, with an oil CEO as president and an oil CEO as vice president and Condi Rice having an oil tanker after named after her, I doubt it, Bernie.
I mean, and this is the outrage of what goes on in Washington. The degree to which they can deflect the tension away from the real needs of tens of millions of working people, put it on one family in Florida, or whatever the issue may be, gay marriage or whatever it may be. With some of us, I want to assure listeners that some of us are going to focus on that issue, and there's some short-term things that we can do to lower the cost of oil in the very near future. Clearly, there are long-term efforts that have to be made to make us a more energy efficient nation. It is insane that we are driving vehicles today that get worse mileage per gallon than was the case 5 or 10 years ago. We're moving in the wrong direction. The technology is there now to get us far greater energy efficiency. We've got to move in that direction. Short term, we should be releasing oil from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, put more oil on the market, tell the oil companies, who, by the way, are enjoying record-breaking profits. So we have a president of the United States, vice president of the United States, deep into the oil industry. Well, their friends are doing just fine. ExxonMobil enjoyed $7 billion in profits in the last quarter. Royal Dutch Shell, $5 billion. The oil industries make it out like a bandits. Now, call me naive, but maybe there might be some relationship to the fact that oil prices are soaring and the industry is making phenomenal profits.
Yeah, it seems there may be an association. At the same time that consumers, average folks, the voters of America, oddly enough, you would think that the politicians would pay attention, are being hammered by oil prices. They're also being spooked by the rise in interest rates.
Absolutely. And there's an issue that is not getting the kind of attention that it deserves. And Bonnie Frank of Massachusetts and I have introduced legislation to address the outrage that is being perpetrated on the American people by the credit card industry. Right now, I am sure that virtually all of our listeners have received solicitations from credit card companies, those very fancy things, sign here, zero interest rates, guaranteed, long-term, all this other stuff, correct?
Yes, sir.
Everybody has gotten them.
Our dog got one.
Your dog got one, right. And generally speaking, the worse your credit history is, the more of these things you get. If you're 18, you're going to get a whole lot of them. In fact, this is unbelievable. In the year 2004, over 5 billion credit card solicitations went out to the American people.
Wait a minute. There aren't 5 billion people in the United States.
Oh, no. Oh, no. I mean, you thought you were the only person getting tons of these things. That's not the case. 5 billion in
Incredible.
America. Now, why are they doing this thing? There is an outrageous bait-and-switch scam which these credit card companies are playing in the American movement. Here's what it is. Sign now, and you're going to get zero interest rate or 3% interest rates. What they forget to tell you is that on page 4 in very small print is they have the right to raise those interest rates at any time for any reason. Sometimes they need no reason at all. Sometimes what they will do is tell you, if you are aware that they raise their interest rates, they will tell you that, well, 3 years ago you were late in paying your phone bill. Or maybe your wife was sick and you borrowed some money. We think you may not be able to pay us back. Meanwhile, and here's what the particular outrage is. People pay their bills on time. You lend me money under a certain arrangement. I pay you back every single month on time the amount of money that I owe you. And yet what these guys do despite that is they can jack their interest rates up to any degree they want,
yeah,
any rate they want. So it is an absolute scam. We have legislation in that would stop it. Our legislation would put in bold print and make people aware when their rates are going up, because very often people don't even know their rates are going up. A guy in my office stumbled on the fact that his rates, I think, went from 9% to 14%. He called up the bank, and the bank said, oh, okay, you got it. We'll lower it back to 9%.
Yep.
This is what it is. It is an outrageous scam. People, you know, are busy paying off the $50 a month, the $100 a month. They don't know that maybe paying at 14% rather than 9%. There are some people who are paying 28%. Meanwhile, the credit card companies are enjoying huge, huge profits. So this is an issue that we are going to focus on.
Yeah, well, I'm guessing you're not going to be on the credit card company's Christmas list this year, Bernie.
No.
Driving into work this morning, I heard a newscast at the top of the hour. It was in one of the network newses, and the newscaster said, looking to continue with the brilliant success of Alan Greenspan, the administration is looking for a replacement for Mr. Greenspan, who is scheduled to retire next year. Somehow, I don't view Greenspan as a brilliant success. Do you?
I certainly do not. And I am on the Financial Services Committee. I have had the opportunity over the years to engage in some very interesting discussions with Alan Greenspan. Greenspan poses, in his slow-speaking way, as some kind of erudite economist looking out for the best interest of the American people. In point of fact, he is a very, very right-wing guy who, among other things, has contributed in the past to Jesse Helms' campaign, who does not, I questioned him. I said, Mr. Greenspan, if you had your way, would you eliminate the minimum wage in America? And he said, well, yes, I would. Guy doesn't believe in the concept of the minimum wage. He believes in tax breaks for the wealthiest people, eliminating the minimum wage. He believes in unfettered free trade to make it easier for his corporate friends to take our jobs to China and other countries where desperate people are paid 20 or 30 cents an hour. Alan Greenspan works hand in glove with the largest corporations and the wealthiest people. He has done a very, very good job for them so that they are today doing very, very well. The CEOs of the Forbes 500 last year enjoyed a 54% increase in their compensation over the previous year. They're doing just great. Middle class is shrinking. Poverty is increasing. Working people are working longer hours for lower wages. We're losing good-paying jobs. Jobs that are being created are, by and large, Walmart-type jobs. That's what Alan Greenspan has fought for. And if people think that that is doing a good job, well, that's fine. I don't see it that way.
Well, I have to say, Bernie, the newscast that I heard it on was coming from one of the big three networks, which is one of those big multinational corporations that Greenspan has been so useful to. So
that's right.
It might have had something to do with it. As you say, what was it, the head of GE was saying China, China, China?
Yep.
Yep, yep, sure enough. And they own NBC, so there you go. Okay, we're talking with Congressman Bernie Sanders. It's our regular Brunch with Bernie segment. Congressman Bernie Sanders with us. His website's bernie.house.gov. or bernie.org. Our telephone number, toll-free, 1-866-889-8894. We'll be right back after this with your calls for Congressman Bernie Sanders. I'm Tom Hartman. It's 20 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back.
I get up every morning and ignore the global warming. Head out to the Oval Office, start my day. I keep my donors all protected so I can be reelected. Give them access just as long as they pay. And to the court.
Yes, it's the George W. Bush Taking Care of Business song. Welcome back, my friends. We have Congressman Bernie Sanders with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment, our regular segment here at the last day of the week. Jeff in Nashville, Tennessee, you're live with Congressman Bernie Sanders.
Hey, Bernie, as I mentioned to Tom last week, 2 weeks ago, Howard Dean was speaking to Bob Schiffer, and he asked him, well, the Democrats don't have a plan, do you, for dealing with Iraq? And his answer was, well, we're not in charge. We can't really offer a plan even if we wanted to. It's not our place to do that. I think it would be great if you would go to Dean and say, let's tell the rest of the world that the spokesman for these issues is Wesley Clark on Iraq and national security. If he went up there, had a press conference with you and said, Dennis is standing next to him, what would be wrong with that idea?
Well, I think what you are hearing, Jeff, are more and more, not only Democrats, but Republicans speaking out on Iraq. And that we've got to fundamentally change the direction in which we are going. We've got to begin bringing our troops home as soon as we can. And by that, I mean not years, but beginning the process within the next few months. This war has cost us terribly in the number of lives that we've lost, the number of wounded, the amount of money that was spent, the devastation in Iraq, and a very strong case can be made by a lot of experts in the area that just the presence of American troops in Iraq alone is acting as a recruiting poster for Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda. There is no question, I don't think anyone debates, that al-Qaeda is now stronger than it used to be. What our job should be is to accelerate the training of Iraqi troops, support the Iraqi government, get other countries around the world to support that country. Bush got us in there. I think we can't desert them by any means. But I think it is counterproductive to continue to keep American troops in there. And you're hearing more and more people, not only Democrats, not only Republicans, but conservative Republicans making that point as well.
Bernie, there are some rumors in the military that this decision's already been made, that we're going to be drawing down the troops substantially before the November 2006 elections so that Republicans don't get just slaughtered by this whole war. We may kick them back up again after November, but that's going to start in the spring. What's your take on that?
Well, you're hearing conflicting statements coming from the Bush administration and from the military. There have been some articles in the paper suggesting that there are going to be substantial cutbacks to the number of troops in Iraq, and you're hearing Bush saying we're going to stay the course. Do I personally believe that if the polls look bad for Bush, that he will suddenly announce that we have done everything that we wanted to do, we got rid of Saddam Hussein, we have free elections, we have a constitution, we're bringing our troops home, no matter what happens in Iraq? Yeah, I think that is a possibility.
Yeah, it's sadly cynical, but there you go. Scott in Kalamazoo, Michigan, you're live with Congressman Sanders.
Well, good afternoon, gentlemen.
Hi.
First, I'd like to say, thanks to Bernie for having the guts to come on a show like Tom's and to do the show month after month and make himself available to a national constituency.
Well, it's becoming year after year now.
Year after year. And I have even more respect for you, Bernie, after reading the current issue of Rolling Stone and the article about you fighting the good fight continuously, against the odds. So I really respect you for that.
Thanks very much, Scott. That was a very good article.
My question is, why isn't Congress, making the... asking the president, Mr. President, I think you owe the American people, the answer to this question. Considering how strongly you made the case to go to war in Iraq, why has every single reason you gave us turned out to be totally and completely wrong? Why are we making a bigger issue of
that? Scott, that is an excellent question. And one of the more ugly aspects of what is going on under Republican control is Congress is abdicating its oversight responsibilities. You'll remember that when Clinton was president, every other day there was another investigation about everything that Clinton did. You remember that?
Oh, yeah.
Meanwhile, outrage after outrage, lie after lie takes place from the Bush administration. Are you seeing any of the congressional chairmen, the committees, and I'm on the Committee on Government Reform, which has oversight responsibility. Have you heard them stand up and say, Mr. President, we want an explanation?
No. I've not heard the media either say, Mr. President, what is that noble cause that Cindy Sheehan's son died for? It's not happening.
Scott made the right point. We need to know why the president told us what he did.
Yeah, well said. 29 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman. We're talking with Congressman Bernie Sanders.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Bend, Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa, Ottawa, Oklahoma, Tampa, Panama, Matamal, Apollo, Bangor, Baltimore, Salvador, Amarillo, Topeka, Anchorage, Padilla, I'm a killer, I've been everywhere.
And welcome back, my friends. 27 minutes before the hour. Talk radio for the rest of us. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program brought to you today by Motor Silk. Motorcycle product that I actually use in my car, and it actually is improving the gas mileage of my Prius. 1-866 less fuel for more information. 1-866 less fuel. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. Congressman Bernie Sanders with us. Our telephone number 1-866-889-8894. And Will in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, you are live with Congressman Bernie Sanders.
Morning, gentlemen. Good morning, Congressman.
Good morning, Will.
Congressman, I've been a personally independent registered voter since 1967 when I came home. There are two higher politicians vote on laws, et cetera, without overthrowing the government, of course, because Tom so very well explained it. It's a republic. It's not a democracy. Second, Tom, this is for...
Actually, I've never explained that, Will. It's both.
Well...
Please don't put words in my mouth. Anyhow, continue your comment.
Wait, I'm sorry. It's both. You're right. You're right. My mistake.
It is Neil Bortz who says it's a republic, not a democracy. But continue, Will.
Okay. This question is for you, Tom, and the next one is for Congressman.
No, I'm not answering questions right now. This is Bernie's hour. What's Bernie's question, Will?
Hey, Congressman Sanders, who are the guilty crooked oil companies that are inflating the prices, these hoodlums that are dictating to our government and have been doing so since 1974?
Okay. Let me follow up your first question, Will, and that is how do you participate, you and every other American, participate in the democratic process? And I think what we have to understand, Will, is that politics is not just voting once every 2 years or every 4 years. It means being involved 365 days a year. It means taking the initiative yourself. As I've said on a number of occasions on this particular show, all you have to do is get a hold of your friends, your family, your co-workers. Get out on the street. Organize people. Bring 100 people together to demand to meet with your local member of Congress, your local mayor, your governor, and say, look, these are the issues. We want you to sit down and answer questions A, B, and C. Let's work on mutually agreed upon time. And take the ball to these guys. You don't have to sit back. And if people who are elected tell you they don't have the time to meet with you, they're not interested in your issues of concern, then you say, fine, that's fair enough. Don't come around asking for my vote in November. In other words, you have got to take the initiative. Just don't sit around. Organize people. And when people get organized, trust me, politicians will begin to listen. And if you don't like what they have to say, then you nominate some other people. And that's the way the democratic process works. We just can't sit around waiting every 2 years or every 4 years for election. People have got to be involved, get vigorously involved. If you like your local representatives and people you've elected, if they're good, fight to defend those guys, make sure they get reelected. That's point number one. Point number two, in terms of the oil companies, I don't think it's one oil company. I think we all remember that when Bush and Cheney got elected way back in 2001, they were meeting, Cheney was meeting behind closed doors with all of the oil industry. The recent so-called energy bill, which gave billions of dollars in corporate welfare to oil companies, nuclear power companies, coal companies, was written by big energy. So it's not just one company. It's the entire energy that exerts enormous influence over this administration, this leadership. See where their campaign contributions go, and it'll go to the same guys who write this legislation, and that is what is happening.
Yeah, and thank you for the call, Will. Sorry if I sounded cantankerous there.
Golden cantankerous.
There you go. It's happening, Bernie. I'm sorry.
What happened to you on hour after hour?
There you go. Joanne in Akron, Ohio. Joanne, you're live with Congressman Bernie Sanders.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. I have a comment and a question. My comment is for Bernie from last week when we talked about impeaching Bush.
Can we talk about what?
Impeaching Bush, if
yeah.
we should get the House. My comment is he can do so much damage if he is not impeached. I mean, and I point to Bolton and the radical judges that have been appointed. That's my comment on that. But my question is, how are the votes in Congress that are voice votes that have been so dubious, how are they recorded?
Okay. In your second question, the way it works is when the Republican and Democratic leadership are in agreement about something. Often there's something, you know, the name of a post office in Pennsylvania, and they don't want to spend, you know, hours discussing the issue. What they do is somebody makes a motion, and if nobody objects to it and demands a roll call vote, it passes by what we call by a unanimous vote. And there is no recorded vote on it.
Okay.
So it's just a voice vote. It's a unanimous vote, and that's how that happens. If somebody wants to object to that process, you jump up on the floor, you get the mic, and you say, I demand a roll call vote, and you can get a roll call vote on those things. But sometimes, in order to facilitate the process, move things along, where there is no disagreement. Often they are innocuous pieces of legislation, naming post offices or thanking the Girl Scouts or whatever it may be. Then they move it along with through unanimous consent.
Okay. Thank you, Joanne. I appreciate the call. Chuck in Grand Rapids, Michigan on the line. Hey, Chuck.
Yeah. Question for Bernie, or a point for Bernie. You were talking about the credit card solicitations.
Yes.
How many of those went out? Something that a lot of people don't realize, I work in the mailing industry, so a lot of people don't realize is what most of those credit card companies are also doing is they're sending them out standard mail. Now, for many people, they don't realize that the old term third-class mail is now called standard, all right? And they're sent out without return service requested. And the Postal Service, is, if they can't find a receptacle, if it's undeliverable, they can throw those in the trash. And those solicitations have our checks, our account numbers on them, and I think the identity theft concern is very hypocritical for the credit card companies to tell us that they're working on that when in fact that they're doing all this. I don't know if that's something that you could also address with some of the other things you're looking at, but I think
Chuck, thank you very much for that information. That is a point that I was not aware of.
That's fascinating. So you're suggesting, Chuck, that credit card solicitations should be first class mail and there should be a return address on them.
Right, because the Postal Service doesn't have to do anything with them if it's undeliverable, and that's your and my credit card account numbers getting thrown into trash.
Right, and then the dumpster divers go for it, and boom, we're toast.
I hope that's a tip to your listeners, too. I appreciate the program. Yeah. Thank you, Bernie. Thank you, Tom.
Thank you, Chuck. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number, Walter in Elizabeth City, North Carolina is on the line. Walter, you're live with Congressman Bernie Sanders.
Hello, Bernie.
Hi, Walter.
I have a question for you. Now, since 1973, we've been having these fuel oil supposedly shortages, and the oil companies, of course, been ripping everybody off. I drive a 18-wheeler. I'm paying $41,000 more last year than I did ever before for fuel.
$41,000 more?
Yes, sir.
Unbelievable.
On a year.
Uh-huh.
Okay? It sounds strange, but I could prove it. Now, figure all these truck drivers that are getting ripped off on this. Nobody's doing nothing about it. Can't the Congress or the senators say, listen, we had enough of this? I mean, you know, the president's got to do something about it. He's in a ballpark with these oil companies, as is Cheney. And I used to work for Sunoco, Sun Oil Company, back in the 70s. The first oil shortage, they came to us and said, do not say anything. This is a hoax, and we're going to make money on it. All our tank farms, you couldn't put another drop of oil in them. The ships out in the Verrazano Narrows, they couldn't pump off. In the meantime, they had the people sitting there waiting in gas stations. If there was a shortage, where would this tanker come from and fill up these gas stations each and every couple of hours? And ever since that time, these oil companies have been getting away with it.
Yep.
Today or yesterday on the news, they're anticipating the hurricane might come along into Louisiana and have a recourse on the refineries. So maybe we should jack the price up. If I tell my customer, mm-hmm. I need tires for my truck, I need to raise my rate, you know what they tell me? Right?
Yes.
And then all of a sudden, now they're using India and China as an excuse that there's a bigger demand for fuel
there. But, Walter, I mean, I think what is clearly an outrage. Have you heard the President of the United States and the Republican leadership, people who run the Congress, saying, we have a major crisis? It's affecting truckers like you. It's affecting farmers. It's affecting aviation. It's affecting average workers in rural areas. We have a major crisis. When is the president and the Republican leadership going to say, we're going to do something, we're going to stand up to the big oil guys? I haven't heard it.
No. And you know what it is? We're probably never going to hear it because he's in cahoots with them.
He is.
And that's sad.
It is very sad.
Our country is getting deteriorated by a bunch of monopolists.
You got it.
Yeah.
All right. But I want to tell you, Walter, some of us in Congress are going to stand up and are going to fight. We need your help. We certainly need the help of truckers. We need the help of working people who can't afford to pay $500 a year more to fill up their tanks to get to work. So let's work together on this issue. But I think we can, if we work together, put enough pressure on this president, we can accomplish something.
Thanks a lot, Walter. Good to hear from you.
You're welcome.
1-866-889-8894. Wendell in Barrie, Vermont on the line. Hey, Wendell, you're live with Congressman Bernie Sanders.
Yes, how are you folks?
Great.
Good.
Bernie, you're from the state of Vermont here as well as I am.
Yep.
Can't something be done about most vehicles on the mileage? I mean, 12, 13 miles to the gallon is nothing. They can at least double or triple that easily. The technology is there. Can't there be something done
of
about it?
Of course there can, Wendell. You are absolutely right. We are moving in the wrong direction. We're moving into worse mileage per gallon, which is basically insane. So the answer is what Congress has got to do is what we call raise the CAFE standards. That's the average mile per gallon standard that cars receive. Of course we can do it. We can do it tomorrow. Unfortunately, this president and the Republican leadership are not doing it. That is one of the efforts that some of us are trying to make. We can drive cars that get 50 miles per gallon. We can substantially increase the mileage for the SUVs, for light trucks. We can do those things. And that's what we've got to do.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Wendell. Great to hear from you. The first couple of years I lived in Vermont, Bernie, I drove a Honda Insight, got 72 miles to the gallon, an actual clocked mileage. It was, you know, and everybody was saying, hey, we can't make that technology. And Honda
yeah.
was making it.
And meanwhile, they got guys, they got engineers working in their garages who are even improving upon that. But when it comes to Ford and Chrysler and General Motors with their billion-dollar research departments, somehow they can't figure it out. Give me a break.
Yeah. Rick in Salinas, California on the line. You're live with Congressman Bernie Sanders.
Pleasure to talk to you both, Congressman. And Tom, you're doing a heck of a job.
Thank you.
I have two quick questions, and then I'll jump off to hear the answers. One would be on Iraq, since this war was on lies and deceit. Pulling out the troops now, I think, would be a bigger catastrophe than having them stay there on the fact that there would probably be a very bloody civil war or a coup, I would think, in Iraq over this, since it already seems to be started between the Shiites and the Sunnis and everybody can't get along there anyway. And number two would be, I think the only man really that can solve this problem would be to put Saddam Hussein back in power. And I would just like to know how you would feel on that, and I'll jump off so I can hear your answer. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Rick.
I voted against the war, and I'm, you know, one of the leaders in opposition to Bush's policies there. But no, I think putting Saddam Hussein back into power would be a real tragedy. This guy, let's not kid ourselves. This guy is a mass murderer. He is a disgusting human being. He ran his country based on fear and terror. He is a criminal. So I don't think we put him back into power. But I think the other issue that Rick raises is important. I don't think you can withdraw the troops tomorrow, but I think we have got to begin to start to withdraw our troops while we accelerate training of the Iraqi military, while we ask the rest of the world to help support financially their military and their government. We don't turn our backs on it. Bush got us into it, but it would be irresponsible simply to walk away from it. But I do believe, as I mentioned earlier, that the presence of American troops in Iraq year after year after year, you know, recently, Tom, we heard some high-ranking generals saying, well, we expect to be there 4 more years. Meanwhile, other people saying, well, we're going to withdraw our troops. They're giving conflicting signals here. But I think the presence of American troops there is exactly what Osama bin Laden has wanted. He talks to the whole world. He talks to Muslims, poor people all over the world, and he said, see, that's what I told you. They want to take over our countries. They want to take over our oils and wage a holy war against these terrible Americans. That's what he has successfully done.
Bush played right into his hand. Jim in Moreno Valley, California. We have about a minute left. Jim, you're live with Congressman Sanders.
Oh, gee, a minute, huh? First of all, I'd like to somebody mentioned the energy meeting that Cheney held. Those papers, in my opinion, belong to the people. This was only a meeting, and it was nothing that should have been secret about it, unless, as is my opinion, these energy people were talking about the use of oil in Iraq. Secondly, and this one is a question, why are our representatives in Washington voting in a manner to suck up to the president when they, as representatives, and the word representatives means to represent the people. Why are they not representing their constituents rather than sucking up to the president? And I'll get off the phone and talk, listen to you.
Okay, Bernie.
Oh, you have a couple of factors. Number one, both the House and the Senate are controlled by the Republican Party. In both cases, the leadership exerts enormous power on their members in the House and Senate to vote with the president. And second of all, big money plays a very important role in influencing how members vote.
Yeah. And those both need to be reformed, in my opinion, but good point. It is 10 minutes before the hour. We're with Congressman Bernie Sanders. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. Our telephone number, 866-889-8894.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Sometimes it's bad.
And welcome back. Yeah, when the going gets tough. But, you know, we get past that. We get through it. We get over it. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Congressman Bernie Sanders with us, our Brunch with Bernie segment, our regular first segment of the day. And Brian on Fridays. And Brian in Houston, Texas is with us. Hey, Brian.
Hi. Yeah, I've got one question that's really been perplexing me. I'm with the congressman. I don't think that we should stay in Iraq, but my fear is, my concern is that we've created such a Pandora's box. If we were to pull out quickly, it's not so much the civil war within the country that concerns me, it's the people from outside, the Iran, the Russia, the China. I see China and Russia had joint exercises last week. You know, this could be really big and nasty, and I'm right. Just wondering what you think of that.
Well, you know, Brian, you make a good point, and it is, I mean, I think Bush has got us into a no-win situation. There are options. What we're looking at is the, in a sense, best-bad option, if you like. I think just keeping American troops in there year after year, getting sucked into that war, losing more people, inflaming our enemies all over the world with our presence there is probably a worse option. So I think we have to begin withdrawing our troops. It's not going to happen tomorrow. We have to ask other countries to provide support for Iraq as we do. But I think keeping our troops in there year after year after year is probably the worst of the options available to us.
Pat in Chicago, Illinois, you're live with Congressman Bernie Sanders.
Yes, how you doing? Hey, look, man, I'm a truck driver. I'm from Chicago. I pull steel for the major steel mills, U.S. Steel, Inland Steel, and pretty much ISG. Well, with the steel, we can't pass our costs on to the customer. When the fuel costs steady going up, well, you try to pass your costs on to the customer, they won't load you no more. And that's the major problem right there. Every other industry, they pass the cost on to the customer. U.S. Steel said it costs them more to make the steel. They rose the price every month up last year. So they felt, hey, look, we're making enough money. But nowhere else, we can't do that.
You guys are getting stuck with the bill then, huh?
Yeah, that's it. We're getting stuck with the bill. Right now, 340 gallons cost you $900. 10 years ago, it cost you $300 to do that. You know, I can't afford to keep doing this, and with my overhead steady getting higher and higher, and when you have the cops out here saying that they're making the roads safer, you're not making the roads safer because you're steady letting these big, large trucks come.
Yeah, right. Pat, I'm sorry, I gotta wrap it up there, Pat.
He
but Bernie, the last few comments are yours. Another 15 seconds.
Paula just said it all. The president, the Congress have got to stand up and start protecting the American people, lower the price of oil, and get us better energy efficiency in America.
Well said. Congressman Bernie Sanders, bernie.house.gov or bernie.org. His websites, check them out. Thanks for being with us, Bernie. We'll see you next week.
See you then, Tom.
Okay,
thank
great.
You.
Thank you, Bernie. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Talk radio for the rest of us.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. 7 minutes past the hour. Is it possible that Ecclesiastes was right, or the book of Ecclesiastes was right, that there is nothing new under the sun? That it seems that everything that happens has happened before. Pierce O'Donnell has a bit of perspective on that. His marvelous new book, In Time of War, Hitler's Terrorist Attack on America. Welcome, Pierce.
Hey, great to be with you.
Great to have you here. Now, here we have a terrorist attack on the United States. Adolf Hitler sent 8 guys over here to blow up things. We caught them, held a military tribunal, executed them, and George W. Bush is pointing to that military tribunal as the basis for what he's doing?
Yes, he's wistfully looking back at what FDR did in 42 and trying to do the same thing.
And when FDR did it, was it wrong?
Not essentially. Really quick story. 8 young Germans had come to America in the Depression for jobs and went back to Germany in the war. They were essentially volunteered, you know, conscripted in the Nazi way for this sabotage mission. They were trained, came to America. They landed in military uniforms, four on Long Island, four and four, quickly went into civilian disguise. When captured ultimately by the FBI, they could have been summarily executed as spies because that's what we call the law of war. You know, they did it to Nathan Hale in the Revolutionary War. I regret I have but one life to live for my country. And spies are routinely in his history have been shot, okay?
Right.
Boom, that's it. But Roosevelt wanted to send a message to Hitler, don't do it again. And he wanted to wake up the American people who were still in shock from Pearl Harbor, that, you know, incredible blow to the national psyche. So he decided to have a military trial, and the only way he could get the death penalty was a military trial. He couldn't get in a civilian court. And that's what Bush is trying to do, set up his own military court system. But the Supreme Court heard a case called Quirin, ex parte Quirin, the name of one of the 8 saboteurs. They upheld the president's authority under the law of war. They didn't really reach the issue whether Congress had authorized it. It's clear to many of us today that Congress, in the so-called war on terror, has not authorized the Guantanamo kangaroo court system, and rather we believe they should be using the conventional court-martial system of the venerable Uniform Code of Military Justice and the 3,500 trained judge advocate general lawyers who do this for a living, Tom.
In reading your book, I was fascinated by the history. I mean, it's just this extraordinary story of these guys, you know, down to, you know, what the interrogations were like. You know, the next day started out the same way. Biddle again decided to skip the actual reading of the confession. You know, it's like reading a Ken Follett novel, frankly, the first half of the book, or maybe 2/3 of it. Toward the end of the book, though, the last Clear and Present Dangers chapter, for example.
Yes.
Is heavily about what's going on in Guantanamo Bay. The conditions of confinement at Camp Delta in Guantanamo Bay are harsh, to say the least, and you go through all the details that they can't have beards and you know, these sorts of things. We look back, we look back on our history at Lincoln suspending habeas corpus during the Civil War, at Wilson's outrageous conduct during the First World War with the, you know, his reinvention of the Alien Sedition Act, well, even the Alien and Sedition Acts of John Adams' time in 1798. And then, of course, Roosevelt with the internment camps for the Japanese. And so, you know, really, in a very real way, I think, I'm not sure that that's the point that you intend to make with the book, but in a very real way, you could say that the history of the United States is one of at times of fear, let's say, not just war, but because with John Adams and the Alien Sedition Acts, there was no war. He was just trying to whip one up with France.
Right.
But in times of fear, we have a tendency to overreact and forget the principles on which this country was founded. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, I think that there's a pendulum that swings quite easily in wartime towards repression, okay? And even though President Bush, for example, after 9/11 gave a speech, which I thought was laudatory, that we shouldn't react reflexively and in a biased way against Arab Americans, Ashcroft went out immediately and rounded up 3,000 Arab American men and accused them of various immigration violations and hinted that we were cleaning up terrorists' cells. None of these gentlemen were ever convicted for any terrorist activities. There were a few immigration convictions. The Inspector General's report of this this activity was harshly critical of the Attorney General for basically fear-mongering. And I think fear-mongering is what we're talking about. We're talking about isolating, whether it's Japanese Americans or Arab Americans, a class of people whom we scorn as a class merely because of who they are, their ancestry, or perhaps their religion. And what I try to do in the book is draw the historical parallels and say, look, hopefully we're more grown up now and hopefully we're more mature, but we tend to make the same mistakes again. Before you accept a claim of national security from the president justifying incarcerating U.S. citizens like Hamdi and Padilla, okay, suspected of terrorism, without charges, without lawyers, without a trial for Padilla now almost 4 years, you better really skeptically scrutinize it, because Roosevelt, as my book points out, as you know, accepted a bill of goods about the military necessity of interning Japanese Americans as a class, and surprisingly, as my book points out, a little twist of irony here, the staunchest opponent to the internment of 120,000 loyal Japanese Americans was who? J. Edgar Hoover.
Now, why would that be?
Well, I think it wasn't so much that he was a civil libertarian, although he thought there was no evidence of broad-scale Japanese treachery. I think it was more an institutional thing that the Justice Department, in which the FBI was housed, should be controlling domestic security and not the War Department. It was the Army. It was the Army that locked him up. Yeah, it was a turf battle. Same battle they had over who was going to try the German saboteurs. The compromise was both Biddle and the Judge Advocate General of the Army, Kramer, would do the trial. So, and today Bush is saying, I'm going to let the military handle these terrible U.S. citizens suspected of terrorism. Now, remember, it turned out the Japanese were not disloyal as a class. Not a single Japanese American was convicted of, or even charged or convicted with treason. And today, we have a situation where they claim this guy Hamdi, who they threw away for 3 years, was a terrible terrorist. And when the Supreme Court said, modest little due process here, he must attend the indefinite incarceration of a citizen, you know what they did with Hamdi?
No.
They released him. They sent him back to Saudi Arabia. They didn't have enough evidence even
without
a minimal showing. So I'm telling America, look, your Congress is sleepwalking through history. There's no effective oversight of the executive branch. The only place we can go to as a default is the judiciary. And both Republican and Democratic appointees, including one of George Bush's own appointees, have enjoined Guantanamo proceedings on various constitutional grounds and international law, Geneva Convention.
I noticed that one of the folks who blurbed your book, Barry Richard, who said, this is a chillingly true story of foreign terrorists who reached American soil almost 60 years before 9/11, was the former lawyer for George W. Bush in the Bush v. Gore case before the Supreme Court, presumably a Republican partisan. Did he give you that blurb because he's had an awakening, or did he not read the last third of the book?
He read the entire book in the final manuscript form, and Barry Richards, a distinguished trial lawyer in Florida, happens to be a registered Democrat, but he's probably single-handedly responsible for Bush, he and the Supreme Court. They say Bush won that election 5-4.
Right.
But Barry was hired, he was paid to represent Bush, and really won that case in the trial courts of in the Supreme Court of Florida. No, he's very concerned, as are a lot of people. And by the way, I've done, you know, dozens and dozens of shows like yours. As you may know, I debated Bill O'Reilly in the Devil's Den a couple of weeks ago. And I've been saying throughout, and I see throughout, that my point of view is cutting across party lines and philosophical points of view. And my position, supported by Colin Paul, John McCain, and William Sapphire, and Antonin Scalia. Now, I woke up one morning and pinched myself to see it in who I was with here. But this is, you know, in a sense, we're the true conservatives in terms of the Bill of Rights. Antonin Scalia, in his dissent in Hamdi last summer, said, a U.S. citizen is a U.S. citizen. And until Congress suspends the writ of habeas corpus, which they eventually did for Lincoln in the Civil War, it hasn't happened here. And therefore, this gentleman, regardless of what he's accused of, and terrorism is a bad thing, is entitled to the full protection of our Bill of Rights and all of his legal safeguards.
Well, in fact, if I may interrupt you, Pierce O'Donnell, author of In Time of War, the Constitution doesn't say that those rights are exclusively for U.S. citizens. It says all persons.
No. It says all persons, as David Cole has brilliantly written, a Georgetown professor. What we do to our non-citizens, we eventually do to our citizens. It is a slippery and treacherous slope. when we isolate, whether it's foreign detainees or immigrants in our country, and single them out for shortcut due process procedures. America is the land of liberty. It's a beacon of hope and opportunity. People rush across our borders to come to this country. And not because the climate's good, it's because the environment, the culture we've built up in 225 years is very special. I like to think we're fighting the war against terror for a reason, not as conquerors, but for the rule of law. The same reason my father was a hero in World War II and to whom I dedicate my book, and why Colonel Royal stood up for 9 hours in the well of the Supreme Court, as I recount in Time of War, defending seven Nazi saboteurs whom he despised for what they were, but they were his clients on trial for their life. And you're right. What we do to non-citizens is very, very important. And I think the Supreme Court took a very positive step last summer in the companion case of Rasul versus Rumsfeld, where they said Guantanamo Bay in Cuba is not a law-free zone. It's not a legal black hole, and you can bring your habeas corpus petition. And that, in a few months, they'll decide a new case involving Mr. Hamdan, alleged driver for Osama bin Laden, and they'll decide the extent to which the Geneva Convention and U.S. laws do protect enemy detainees.
But Pierce O'Donnell, have we not, I mean, don't we have a reality here where the Supreme Court has actually ruled that the people in Guantanamo Bay should have access to due process and the administration is not offering it to them? I mean,
no.
Isn't there a disconnect there?
There's a huge disconnect. The Supreme Court said that they have the right to bring habeas corpus petitions, didn't rule on the merits. The president has taken the extraordinary position, which a first-year law student would scoff at. Well, the court said they could file a petition, but there's still no right to challenge their conditions of confinement and the lawfulness of the their detention. Now, that a first-year law student the first week would dismiss as sheer sophistry, okay?
But this was Mr. Gonzalez who put this...
Alberto Gonzalez, the author of the torture is okay memo,
right.
And because we have a new paradigm called the War on Terror. By the way, one thing I have is a website, www.entirewar.org. I list all the key source documents in this debate going back to the Civil War.
Oh, great.
If you want to read Gonzalez's memo, go to my website, entirewar.org, and click source documents, and you'll see the current attorney general, the guardian of our liberty and enforcer of our law, taking an extraordinary position. You'll see a memo from Colin Powell and his general counsel in the State Department, which really is an eloquent and elegant defense of why America goes to war and that we want to be sure that our soldiers are protected by things like the Geneva Convention. Now, you know, I get the conservative talk show hosts say, yeah, but they're cutting our guys' heads off, and why shouldn't we cut their heads off? Because we're different. We stand for something. We're fighting this war for values. We will win the war on terror. I am confident of that, as we defeated fascism, as we defeated communism. But we must be triumphant for a reason. And as Daniel Shore said, I hope the Bill of Rights doesn't look starkly different. This war is over.
Yeah, well said. Pierce O'Donnell, the book is In Time of War, Hitler's Terrorist Attack on America. Marvelous book. It's out in hardcover now in bookstores near you. Check it out, intimeofwar.org, the website. Pierce, thanks for being with us today.
Great. Love to be back again sometime. Have a nice weekend. Buddy.
Thank you, Pierce. You too.
Bye-bye.
It's 20 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Propaganda, propaganda. Try and convince the folks the beach is never sandy. You can convert into lies what they've seen with their own eyes. It's amazing. Propaganda.
Yes, as good old George W. says, it takes a while to catapult the propaganda. Today, by the way, apparently, according to the folks in the chat room, the anniversary of the 19th Amendment... that in 1920 gave women the right to vote in the United States. According to the book I have, it was ratified on the 19th or the 18th of August. The New York Times says it was today. So happy birthday to that. And a happy birthday also to Ben Birch, the fellow who runs White Rose Society. Happy birthday, Ben. You can check out White Rose Society, whiterose.org. They have archives of our program, and they carry a live stream of our program and prepare the podcast for our program. Greg Gorman of the Talk Radio News Service is with us. Hey, Greg, what's up?
Shouldn't this be called Suffrage Day then or something?
There you go. It should be, yeah.
I mean, you know, like, that's a big deal.
It really was.
It's a huge deal. I mean, it's, you know,
we also don't have a holiday that celebrates the end of slavery in the United States.
That's right, although I'm from Texas, and in Texas we do. When slavery ended in the state of Texas, it happened on June 19th, and we call that day Juneteenth, and it's a very big celebration still to this day in the middle of summer.
Huh. It's a positive celebration for the
world? Absolutely positive.
That's marvelous. Greg, can you do a Texas accent if you grew up in Texas?
Well, sometimes I can. If you think you want me to talk this way, then I'm going to talk this way the rest of the time, Tom.
I had a guy from Texas on this program a while ago, and he said George W. Bush's accent is not actually Texan, that he was born in Connecticut. He grew up at Andover in Massachusetts, his prep schools. He went to Yale and Harvard, and he really didn't live in Texas until he was in his 20s, and he picked it up wrong. Is that true?
That is true, and, you know, the entire Bush family sort of is really an East Coast family, and George Bush, 41, moved to West Texas, obviously, when he was a young man, and that's how he got involved in oil in the beginning, and he also represented that district in West Texas, and that's how the Texas connection started with the Bush family, and George W. Bush was not raised in Texas until later, and, you know, it is an accent I think you can pick up and, you know, and take away, but it worked for him up until recently as just being a good old boy kind of frat boy accent, and now I think people are kind of looking at it like, I'm not so sure that it's as sincere as maybe we thought in the beginning.
Well, actually, in that speech where he started out, you know, I see the a lot of wealth here or whatever, the haves and the have-mores, some people call you, you know, I call you my base. You listen to the rest of that speech, and he's speaking in perfect East Coast English. He doesn't have an accent.
That's right. He
can turn it on and turn it off.
That's right. I was going to say, he knows how to tailor to an audience when he goes to a place like Idaho, where he was over the past week. That's a crowd that can relate to him being from the open spaces of Texas, and when he comes back to Washington sometimes, although I think he should probably do it more often than he does it, he should speak in his East Coast dialect, because sometimes people here on the East, in the Northeast, don't really understand what he's saying.
Well, that may just say.
Yeah,
that may have to just do with how his mind works. Anyhow, we got about a minute and a half left, Greg. What's happening in Washington, D.C. today?
Well, I'll just tell you that I've been hypothesizing for a week now why the White House has not made a bigger deal about the president's involvement in the Iraqi Constitution. I think that this will be a thorn in his side, that there is no Iraqi Constitution, and it's all these delays have been happening. The president wishes he could come home, and this was, I think, a done deal. We find out today that President Bush spoke to a Shiite leader, Aziz al-Hakim, on Wednesday. We just heard about it this morning from the White House, that he is more involved in this process, just as I suspected he would be. This is something that the president needs. He needs it to be finished. He needs it to be representative of all people. He needs the Sunnis to be represented. He needs equal rights for women, like we talked about earlier in the week. And now we know that he is more involved than we thought. I think the White House is worried, and I think the president really hopes that by the time he comes back, there is a fully functioning Iraqi constitution, or at least one that's written. The other news is that we now know that Cindy Sheehan is going to go on a bus tour. There are some pro-war test ralliers headed to Crawford for the last week and a half, and then she's going to end up in Washington, D.C. on September 24th, which has now turned into a big war rally day. So that'll be a big day to look for.
Yeah, it's a lot of people, I'm sure, are going to be converging on Washington for weekend in September
That's
24th.
Right.
Greg Gorman, thanks. Great to be in touch with you. Great to hear your voice again, Greg.
Always good to be with you, Tom.
Yeah, thank you very much. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 29 minutes past the hour.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, 27 minutes before the hour, the place where smart people get their news, the Tom Hartman Radio Program. And very often on Friday afternoons, we take a look at the best of the rest of the news. What else? What is going on in the news? that you may not have known about or that you heard about but you didn't hear the whole story on. And for that, we look to some of our finest sources in the Internet. Today we have with us Mark Carlin, who is the publisher, editor of BuzzFlash.com, and Mira Patasan, who is the associate editor, is it, Mira?
Assistant editor,
thank you very much, at commondreams.org, two of the finest websites on the Internet there. Mark, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon, Tom.
Good afternoon, and welcome, Mira.
Hi there.
Mira, what are the, over the last week, what have been the big stories on commondreams.org that you think are going to really influence the future of this country?
Well, we've been following the Cindy Sheehan case for a long time. We have such a strong anti-war vibe at Common Dreams, so we've really been focusing a lot on Cindy. But just a minute, Pierce O'Donnell quoted David Morse saying, "What we do to non-citizens, we eventually do to our own." And this reminded me of an article that really struck me this week about disappointing corporate mentality and corporate representation. And on Monday, Coca-Cola is in deep trouble right now. The Atlanta-based Coca-Cola company began operating a $25 million budget bottling plant in an impoverished village in India. And last week, the village's name is Kerala Village.
Mm-hmm.
And the Kerala State Pollution Board has ordered Coca-Cola to shut down its bottling plant because they have been distributing free fertilizer to the tribal aborigines, and it's cadmium-laden waste sludge. The fertilizer is.
So they're trying to buy off the goodwill of local people by giving them toxic waste?
It's true.
Yes. What, do they think nobody would notice?
Really hit. Well, the company is being shut. This bottling plant is being shut down, but I have not seen it anywhere on any of the local news stations, like CNN, MSNBC, Fox, C-SPAN. It has not been covered. And when I saw this article, I was shocked. And some of the local villagers have to walk miles to get drinking water, while Coke is just sucking up the resources of the village.
They're sucking they're drying out their wells by pulling up all this water to bottle.
It's true.
Yeah. That's remarkable. That's remarkable.
It's very disappointing.
Yeah.
And it hasn't really been covered much on the news. So the closure is a good thing, but the company's merit is just a disappointment.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you, Mira. And Mark Carlin, what are you seeing as the top story or stories on BuzzFlash.com this week that you think are going to have some legs?
First of all, Tom, I'd say that the top story is that there are top stories usually during the dog days of August. You read about pythons that are caught in the bottom of swimming pools and things of this nature, but the news has not let up. First of all, I would agree that Cindy Sheehan remains the top story. This is the first time in 5 years of the Bush administration we have seen an individual go head-to-head with Bush and get the better of him. Ironically, it wasn't a Democratic politician, sadly enough, but it was a mother of a young man, a serviceman who had been killed in Iraq.
Mark, do you think that when he goes back to Crawford, he might just go out and have a meeting with her and get it over with?
I think his handlers are scared that he would not be able to handle it. His presidency has been one that is so carefully scripted and every situation so controlled that to put him in a situation with a woman who is smarter than he is, more courageous than he is, and more tenacious than he is just too dangerous for them. It would be the logical PR thing to do to defuse the situation from their perspective. But I don't think Karl Rove or anyone around Bush trust him to handle the situation.
Hmm. Interesting. Okay.
Isn't it somewhat striking how Bush is taking a verbal strike at peace activists, but he's been pretty mum on Pat Robertson's statement?
Yeah.
Well, I was going to say the other big story, which in some ways may be a diversion, because I don't think Pat Robertson, as goofy as he is, just all the time says these things on his own. The administration has had their eyes on Hugo Chavez for some time. In fact, he's our GOP Hypocrite of the Week today, and if people go to BuzzFlash.com, they can read our story about Pat Robertson and his comments about Chavez. In essence, we really think he was floating a trial balloon for the Bush administration. It wasn't just a goofy remark he made.
Well, and he wasn't the first. I mean, the right-wing talk show hosts and right-wing publications have been suggesting the assassination of Chavez for months. Well, basically ever since the failed coup in 2002.
Which was sponsored by the U.S., and,
right.
And not coincidentally, Donald Rumsfeld was down in Paraguay last week signing an agreement to set up a base of military operations there, basically to control South America for the U.S. Resource interest, meaning in the case of Venezuela, the fifth largest exporter of oil in the world, their vast oil reserves. And we have to remember, this is the most important thing, Tom, that Hugo Chavez was elected democratically, just as Salvador Allende was. This is what Bush is claiming he is spreading democracy for, and what we're fighting, his latest reason for fighting in Iraq. And yet, we are actually talking about assassinating a man who was democratically elected, and then who
with Jimmy
was,
Carter observing the elections.
Yeah, and then in a plebiscite about whether he should be recalled or not, he won that one, too, after the attempted coup. So we don't hear anyone saying, well, he was democratically elected. We just hear that he's a danger to U.S. policy because he's friends with Castro, when in reality what he's trying to do is redistribute the wealth. The real sin for the Bush administration and Hugo Chavez is that he is a champion of the poor, and that's a threat to the oil companies.
Yeah, it's pretty remarkable. 1-866-889-8894, by the way, our telephone number. And let's take a couple of calls here, Mark and Mira, if you don't mind. Jim in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. You have
Hi.
A question for Mark or Mira?
Well, I have two remarks that I'd like to, you know, for him to look into later. They're saying that the people are picketing Walter Reed Hospital, the veterans in there. That's not true. They're picketing the close down of the Walter Reed Hospital. Am I correct?
Yeah, the
okay.
Base closure.
So what mentioned. They're doing, they're putting a Gestapo scare tactic. Joe Gable used to do that. You know, he said the best thing to do is scare the people and then question their patriotism. And this is what they're doing. And then getting on to Iraq. I want to know, are we fighting a war? Are we separating the different religious beliefs over there?
Yeah, we're dealing with a civil war, Jim, and thanks for the call. Mira Patasin of CommonDreams.org, what's the buzz, as it were, the discussion on CommonDreams.org about the war in Iraq? And for that matter, the base closings as well, if that's bubbling up.
Well, as far as the buzz on, our top headline of the day is Iraq is on the brink of a meltdown,
mm-hmm.
which it seems to have been for a long time. The political process is in danger. I mean, we once again failed a vote on the draft of the Constitution. It just seems to be becoming more and more of a quagmire, and I think a lot of what is the outcome will be depends on the Constitution and how far along that's going to move. Anytime soon.
Yeah. Any personal guesses on that? I know you're a fairly keen observer of the news.
I think we're going to be dragging our feet for a while, but it's so hard to it's really difficult to predict. I'm mostly focusing on the U.S. Citizen involvement, especially with Cindy Sheehan and this large protest coming up on the 24th.
Mm-hmm. Looking at the domestic side of it here.
Yeah, I'm curious on how big of an impact we may possibly have because of what Cindy has done in the past 2 weeks. She's just blown up.
Yeah, it really seems to me that this thing on the 24th in Washington, D.C. could become the next, like the March on Washington by Martin Luther King, or it could become like the next Chicago 1968 Democratic Convention, or it may end up being a non-event. And I just have no idea which way it's going to go.
Right.
Mark Carlin, what are your thoughts on all that?
I think the Constitution is a sham. It's a PR event for Bush, and they're failing at that. They wanted to have something to hold up and say, you see, we've accomplished this. And most of the mainstream press would then write editorials saying that the war has been worth it. There's a Constitution. The Constitution is just a piece of paper that
Sunnis are going to revolt because they won't have a sufficient guarantee of political power. The Kurds will only stay in if they get some of the oil fields in the northern sector of Iraq. And the Shiites, according to reports this morning, are split amongst themselves. And actually, there's infighting, that is, shooting among the Shiites, not just between the Shiites and the Sunnis and the Kurds. So it's just a piece of paper. It's not going to have any impact. We wrote an editorial this week which basically said, let's step back a second and look at Iraq. This is the story of Bush's life. He has had failure after failure in his life. He's always had his parents' friends, his dad's friend, come and pull his butt out of the frying pan in Hartgen oil and Zapata oil and everything he's ever done. And now we as a nation are dealing with the same dilemma his family had to deal with a wastrel son who was basically a rich frat boy who couldn't handle business. And he just keeps saying, stay the course, and no one knows what the course is. But we as a nation are left with that. I must say I'm extremely, and Buzz Flash is disappointed with Democrats like Joe Biden keep saying, toss in more troops, you know, to send good after bad. And this is the attempt to, again, save Bush from the disasters that he kind of leaves in his wake. His daddy friends used to do it, but we as a nation don't have to do it.
Yeah, well said. Mark, what do you see as the big stories coming up this week?
Well, we have to be a little bit scared, I think, and a little bit looking around behind our backs to see what's coming, because let's remember that Andrew Card said before they rolled out the Iraq war that the August was not a good time to roll a new product in the propaganda campaign. Right. He didn't call it a propaganda campaign, but he said, we're going to begin the marketing for the war in Iraq
in
the
September,
fall.
Yeah.
So the issue is, you know, Rove is taking this hit in the polls for Bush, and what is he planning to roll out in the fall to distract the country and to cause enough fear that they will stop worrying about Iraq? And perhaps the most likely vehicle for doing that would be to attack Iran, the nuclear installations.
Do you think it just seems to me attacking Iran is so fraught with danger. Attacking Syria, on the other hand, would be relatively easy. Might they not go after Syria first?
Well, that's a possibility. I mean, you know, this is all a guessing game and speculative. None of us are on the inside. I'm sure Cheney has a number of contingency plans that include a Gulf of Tonkin type of incident that would give them justification for going into Syria or Iran. The thing about Iran is one of the problems they have created. The Iraqi war has been such a disaster on so many levels, including, as we know, increasing terrorism rather than decreasing it. Increasing the risk to our national security rather than decreasing it. But one of the key things is if the U.S. does start to pull out, which we certainly favor, but the reality is that you're going to have an Iranian domination of the Shiite majority in Iraq and basically Iranian domination of the oil field. So I think from Cheney's perspective, he sees a limited amount of time due to domestic political pressure to stay in Iraq, and therefore he might feel compelled that he has to, quote-unquote, resolve the Iranian situation by bombing the nuclear installations.
Yeah, and let's keep in mind that Iran has now signed an agreement with Iraq, a mutual defense agreement, a friendship treaty, and a $1 billion reconstruction.
Ain't that ironic?
Yeah, that Iran is giving to Iraq. Mira Patasin, CommonDreams.org. Mira, what's the discussion on Common Dreams about the whole Iranian situation, and what do you see as the big stories coming down the road here?
Big stories coming down the road. We're going to be following the Iraq political process, but personally, I think a lot of what we are going to be running depends on the activism of citizens. I really sense a lot of energy coming from the peace movement, and Bush seems to become, he's losing his approval ratings, and I think we're going to be covering a lot of the movement, which is building bigger and bigger. I think we're going to start leading up to coverage of this
this protest coming the 24th. And just following Cindy and the domestic protests in the United States right now.
Okay. Dave in Eureka, California has a question for both of you. We only have a little less than a minute left. Dave, real quick.
Well, the reality is an added complication for the Bush crew there. They cannot speak to the Cindy people because there is no noble purpose. This is all about a new world order. It's about shifting wealth to their corporate special interests. He can use the terms like follow the course, stay on course, or...
Yeah, but the bottom line is that there is no noble cause. Mark Carlin, BuzzFlash.com.
Yes, we've seen so many different reasons that Bush has used for invading Iraq, but now, as Maureen Dowd pointed out from the New York Times, he's kind of left with this: we have to continue fighting to honor the soldiers who have already died on behalf of a cause that we don't really know what it was. That's sort of what he's been left with, and
yeah.
That's pathetic.
And that's pretty tragic. That's pretty tragic. Mark Carlin from Common Dream, from BuzzFlash.com, and Mira Patasin from CommonDreams.org. Thank you both so much for being with
us
today.
Thank you, Tom.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. For our best of the rest of the news segment, it's been great. It's always good to get the insight of the folks who are inside the news machine and really have their finger on the pulse of what's going on. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, Exposing the Con in Conservative.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman program.
I hate Walmart.
Uh-oh.
If you didn't hear the story, well, here's how it is. Big company sell the low cost, drive mom and pop out of business. Pretty soon all over the land, one big square store, identical brand, and that's why I hate Walmart.
And welcome back, my friends. 55 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Our program brought to you today by Eco Wine, the organic wine company, 1-888-ECO-WINE, ECOWINE, or 1-888-326-9463. And, of course, their website, ecowine.com. An interesting story here. We all know that there's this horrible and dangerous possibility that the flu virus that is now infecting millions of birds across Asia right now, and they're migrating into Russia, into Europe. By next spring, they'll be migrating through Canada and into the west coast of the United States, down the east coast of the United States, that this flu virus has the potential. It's the H5N1 virus, which is very similar to the virus that killed so many people in the Spanish flu epidemic of 1918. It has the potential to kill millions and millions of people. And now we find, this is a story from Cox News Service by Jeff Neesmith, that the U.S. government is saying that in the event that there is a major flu outbreak in the United States, it's not going to be handled by the Department of Health and Human Services, which you would expect. That includes the U.S. Public Health Services, the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC. They're not going to handle it. Instead, it's going to be the Department of Homeland Security. Michael Chertoff has come out and said that his agency, the major police agency for the United States, will take over running this country in the event that we have a pandemic, a bird flu pandemic. His HHS would make decisions within its area of expertise, as would other federal, state, and local agencies, he said. Chertoff said that in the event of a pandemic, the government would depend heavily on health expertise within HHS, but, quote, we would manage the incident, particularly with the view to make sure that all of the other pieces that could flow from the pandemic would be properly addressed. Boy, this is going to set off a lot of alarm bells. Those, you know, the folks who are concerned about the FEMA, and is FEMA building prison camps around the United States? And what is the ultimate crackdown on democracy going to... I mean, here they're just coming right out and saying, hey, if we have a flu epidemic, the police are going to take over the country. Somehow it seems to me like the doctors should, but, you know, just call me old-fashioned. Anyhow, the Department of the Homeland Security, the head of the Department of Homeland Security, said Tuesday his agency and not the federal health establishment will manage the country's response if a deadly new strain of bird flu evolves into a human pandemic. We'll be following this story, this and more, as time goes on here over the next few weeks. It's the Tom Hartman Program, fair and slightly unbalanced.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, 7 minutes past the hour. You know, this I mentioned the story about the bird flu. And, you know, there's a lot in the news. The Iraqi Constitution, Cindy Sheehan, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There's a lot in the news, but this thing with the bird flu really is something that I think the United States should be paying more attention to. In England right now, the government is officially searching for sites for mass graves. They have put together a civil defense program. They have a code name for it. I mean, this has been talked about in the British media, in the British press. How is the country going to deal with an epidemic that might kill, you know, millions of people? England, by the way, has been through such epidemics before, not only the Spanish flu in 1918, but the Black Death in the, 1450s, as I recall, or 1540s, or whenever it was, way back when. So it's interesting to go back and look. One of the folks in our chat room, by the way, thank you very much, pointed me to this. legitgov.org/flu_oddities.html. And it's an archive of stories about the flu from, you know, the Washington Times and the New York Times and the Washington Post. And in chronological order, you can go way back and look at that, you know, these stories, and this from March of 2005 in New Zealand newspaper. New Zealand medical authorities may tell some people likely to die from bird flu pandemics to stay home and not clog up hospitals. Go back to 2004. This is interesting. This is from the wisconsin.edu, from the University of Wisconsin, October 6, 2004. Yoshiro Kawahaka has used a gene resurrected from the virus that caused the 1918 Spanish flu epidemic, recorded history's most lethal outbreak of infectious disease, to find a single gene that may have been responsible for the devastating virulence of the virus. The October 7 edition of the journal Nature describes experiments in which engineered viruses were made more potent by the addition of a single gene. Using a comparatively mild form of influenza A virus as a template, Kawaoka's team added the two 1918 genes that code for hemagglutinin and neuraminidase and infected mice with the engineered viruses. Say, what? And then March 24th, 2005, this is in the Washington Times. Actually, a UPI story. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has begun a series of experiments to see how likely the bird flu virus could result in a human pandemic. 6-month series of experiments. CDC scientists inside an ultra-secret laboratory. Say, what? Have started swapping the genes of the H5N1 avian virus with the genes of the H3N2 virus, the strain behind most recent human flu outbreaks. And then this is where it gets really interesting. This is from Reuters. On April 1st, 2005, the headline, George Bush order, this is a presidential order, allows isolation of those with bird flu. George Bush issued a directive on Friday allowing authorities to detain or isolate any passenger suspected of having avian flu when arriving in the United States aboard an international flight. The Bush order added pandemic influenza to the list of diseases for which quarantine is authorized. Under the directive, the Health and Human Services Department is given legal authority to detain or isolate any passenger suspected of having avian flu. And then on the 2nd of April, 2005, this headline from the New York Times, Bush authorizes use of quarantine power in cases of bird flu. So apparently, you know, and then we get up to March, April, May, here, May 2nd, this from the Daily Telegraph News. Preparations for any potential flu pandemic were not perfect, but the federal government was doing all it could, Health Minister Tony Abbott said today. Let's see, the Daily Telegraph. I believe that's Australia. In fact, I'm sure that's Australia. I used to read the Daily Telegraph when I was in Australia. Speaking at a communicable disease control conference in Sydney, yep, there it is, Mr. Abbott said the next flu pandemic could be, quote, a worldwide biological version of the Indian Ocean tsunami. That from May. Also in May, Tom Salar, experts are unsure if the bird flu virus will mutate enough. Well, the headline is enough. Avian flu pandemic could be massive disaster and few are noticing. Now, I'm not, you know, getting into this and talking about this just to try and scare the bejesus out of people. There is a lot that can be done for a bird flu epidemic or for any kind of, you know, serious flu epidemic. And it's not like we don't have the means to do it. You know, the cost to build a factory, get it up and running and start manufacturing, for example, Tamiflu, the drug that can actually stop the flu virus from killing you. There's only one factory in the world that makes it. It's in Switzerland. And it could be manufactured here in the United States. And it would cost, what, the equivalent of maybe 2 days in Iraq? George W. Bush, the only thing that he's done that I can tell on this thing so far is he said, you know, we can fill our jails with these people. And here, you know, yesterday we have Michael Chertoff, the head of the Homeland Security Department, saying, yeah, we're going to take charge if there's a bird flu epidemic. The police agent, the FBI is going to run the country. I mean, shades of good old General What's-His-Name. You know, I'm in charge. 4 May 2005. The Marburg virus is mutating. Polio is mutating. Cambodia confirms fourth bird flu death. This was on May 4th, 2005. And in the United States, you know, George has to take a vacation. Sorry, he's got to get on with his life. May 8, 2005, Vietnamese doctors are reporting that the mortality rate for avian flu influenza in their country has dropped substantially, but while this is good news for survivors, it could mean the outbreak of bird flu in Southeast Asia is taking an ominous turn. If the disease quickly kills everyone it infects, it has little chance of spreading very far. Less lethal bird flu becomes, they say, the more likely it is to develop into a global pandemic, they fear, potentially killing tens of millions of people. That from May 8th in the Star Tribune. And, you know, coming all the way up to today, of course, you know, more and more stories about this kind of thing. The flu oddities, as we say. 26 August 2005, Britain's public health experts are losing sleep over the threat posed by bird flu to Britain's health and economy. One of them revealed yesterday. That from the Scotsman. This from the Times Online, the London Times. Spread of bird flu virus is a national emergency, is the headline. Experts from across Europe are meeting today to develop a strategy to stop the spread of a deadly strain of avian flu, which one British scientist has declared a national emergency. 25 August 2005, the Daily Telegraph in the UK. Avian flu undoubtedly, in quotes, will hit UK. Britain on alert, 25 August 2000. This is 25 August, that's yesterday. Yesterday, we're reading yesterday's papers. This is from the Independent. Britain on alert as bird flu heads towards Europe. Britain is to begin testing wild birds for avian flu as EU officials meet today to discuss the growing health threat from a deadly strain of the virus. Scientists fear that a lethal form of bird flu that can infect humans may be brought into the country this autumn by migrating waterfowl. ABC News. And this is actually out of Japan. Bird flu again. I'm wondering if this is the Australian Broadcasting Corporation. I'm not sure. Bird flu again detected in Japanese poultry. Bird flu again. Agriculture Ministry says 22 August 2005, authorities have detected another outbreak of bird flu at a poultry farm near Tokyo. Flu measures urged for UK. 22 August 2005. Lock up your chickens. this is from the Daily Record, a paper in the UK. Here in Italy, this is what they're doing about it in Italy, Channel 24 in Italy. The Rome Fiumicino International Airport has begun implementing precautionary measures involving passengers and merchandise originating from regions affected by bird flu, the airport said on Saturday. Passengers traveling to the Rome airport from China or Russia may be immediately hospitalized in an infectious disease clinic if they show signs of respiratory problems, airport authorities said in a statement. This from the Telegraph. This from the 21st of August, 4 days ago. Flight H5N1 is approaching Britain. Brace for impact. Some scientists are already drawing parallels with the so-called Spanish flu outbreak of 1918, in which another bird flu virus, codenamed H1N1, hit the right genetic combination needed to trigger human-to-human transmission. The resulting pandemic led to at least 20 million deaths, double the number of people killed in the First World War. The population is higher now, says Professor Neil Ferguson, an expert on virus epidemics at Imperial College in London. The population is higher now, so we could be talking about 100 million deaths or more. The 1918 scenario is within what people should be planning for. But is George Bush planning for it? Other than planning to turn the country over to the police agencies, as far as we can tell. Oh, and lest I forget, the Wall Street Journal ran an article about this about 6 or 8 months ago. It was when I still lived in Vermont. It might have been 10 months ago. And I reported it on this program, those of you who are longtime listeners will remember, about how they were, essentially it was sort of one of these wink, wink, nod, nod recommendations. It wasn't, I mean, it didn't recommend. It was basically what it was saying was affluent people are stockpiling Tamiflu, the one drug that can stop this stuff. Americans who have money are stockpiling Tamiflu, and you might want to think about it. And then, you know, the word got a little hotter. And now we find that France has ordered so much Tamiflu, and the United Kingdom have ordered so much Tamiflu, and Switzerland have ordered so much Tamiflu, that the factory that makes it in Switzerland now has a 2-year back order. And if you're in the United States, you can't get it anymore, except for the few 100,000 doses that the Bush administration bought. We have no idea where those are going to go. Is it to the RNC? Is it to the party members? 1-866-889-8894 is our telephone number. We have a break coming up in 23 seconds. We'll take your calls right after that. Let me just wrap this up here. This from China Daily. This is from the Chinese newspaper. Bird flu may cause global economic mayhem. Financial analysts predict that an avian flu epidemic would have dire consequences on the global impact economy, its impact comparable to the Great Depression of the 1930s. And again, what is the Bush administration doing about this? I'm sorry, George Bush has told us officially he's got to get on with his life. He's got his mountain bike to ride. Now we know why he's getting in such great shape to be able to fight off the bird flu when it comes. Maybe that's why he interviewed that one Supreme Court justice and asked him how much he worked out. And the guy didn't work out enough, so Bush didn't hire him. He took John Roberts instead, who's an athlete. 20 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I'm just an old truth teller. I'm your candy.
And welcome back, my friends. Your old truth teller here, 25 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman with you. Our program brought to you today by Small Dog Electronics, 1-800-511-MAX, M-A-C-S, 1-800-511-MACS. So you can get the latest iPods there and all things computer. Give them a shout. Say Tom Hartman says hello. The four horsemen, one of the folks in our chat room made the note, gee, if this happens, this bird flu epidemic happens, it's really going to screw up the rapture plans of Pat Robertson and the hyper-millennialists. No, I would say, actually, it just kind of goes along with it. Revelation 6:8. This is the story of the four horsemen of the apocalypse. The fourth horse was the pale horse. I looked, and there before me was a pale horse. Its rider was named Death, and Hades was following close behind him. They were given power over a fourth of the earth to kill by sword, famine, and plague, and by the wild beasts of the earth. So, you know, without getting too biblical here, I think that the folks, you know, the rapture folks, and keep in mind, the biggest selling books in the world are not the Harry Potter books. They're the Left Behind books about what happens in the last days. And, you know, these folks, war in the Middle East, cool. That's going to bring about the last days. Flu epidemic, cool. That's part of the last days. It's like disasters are just fine with them. I mean, you go back and look at... Reagan's Secretary of the Interior had said, you know, well, you know, why are we selling off the natural wealth of this country? Well, because Jesus is going to come soon, and when he does, all things will be made new, or the rapture is going to happen, and we won't be here to worry about it. We being the good Christians. I mean, this is pretty strange, but there's that kind of thinking out there in a big way. Mike in Washington, D.C. on the line. Hey, Mike, what's on your mind today? Oops, sorry, Mike. I didn't have the button pushed. Go ahead.
Oh, no problem. Tom, I just wanted to point out, you know where the 1918 flu epidemic actually started, right?
I don't.
Kansas.
Well, yeah, okay. You're in the United States. Actually, you know, it was called the Spanish flu for a while because the guess was that soldiers from World War I, possibly from Spain, who came back to the United States brought the flu virus with them. But yes, the first outbreak was in an army hospital or an army barracks in Kansas.
No, but what happened actually is it started in Kansas. It went to Europe, spread there, intensified there, and then came back as the Spanish influenza, but it started from all the farm boys in Kansas who had not been exposed to this, to flu in general, in the army camps, getting infected and taking it to Europe with them.
Yeah, I read a book about 4 years ago, 4 or 5 years ago. It was this great big thick book, Laurie Garrett's book, I forget the title, Plague or something like that, which had, you know, a very, very long chapter in about the Spanish flu, and I recall what you're saying, yeah. So what's the point, Mike?
The point is, I don't know if you caught the BBC last night, but they've been whacking chickens in England recently.
Yeah.
In the tens of thousands. Why? Because they've been showing signs of the avian flu. It has spread as far as England, at least.
My goodness. Yeah,
so
the last I heard was like last week where they were talking about, well, the migrations are beginning, the birds are, in fact, it was on commondreams.org, I read it, the birds are starting to leave the Asia, and they're heading for Europe, and they're heading for Siberia, and, you know, we need to keep an eye out for them. Apparently, they're already there. I can't see the BBC. I don't have the BBC on my TV here. Scary stuff. Mike, thank you very much.
Sure, Mike.
Yeah. Boy, oh boy. See, this is the thing. It's why are we not saying to our elected officials, hey, what are you going to do about the bird flu? Why are we not stockpiling 350 million doses of Tamiflu in the United States? I mean, you know, just as a starting point. It would cost less than a week in Iraq. We could certainly do it. Maybe. I mean, we could do it. The question is it too late now? Has the Bush administration, has Rome been fiddling while, or Nero been fiddling while Rome burns here? Has the Bush administration been so obsessed with Iraq and with Bush's image and Karl Rove and all this other stuff that they've let this happen? 29 minutes past the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
God bless you, Cindy Sheehan, for walking this road you are on. Many more
sons may live a little longer, even though Casey is gone. The president lied to his people. He ran when his time came to fight. He's a man without honor or any regret, and justice will gather him, yeah, oh, yes, it will.
And welcome back, my friends. Yeah, God bless you, Cindy Sheehan. Absolutely remarkable. I just got an email from one of the folks in our chat room, a link from Matt Hogan, Acting Director, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Most of us have read or heard media and other accounts regarding the spread of the highly pathogenic avian influenza referred to as H5N1. To date, this virulent form of avian influenza has not been detected in either wild or domestic birds or in humans in North America. Isn't that marvelous? I'm just profoundly reassured, I have to tell you. I'm very happy. Scott Forrester is here engineering the program today. And, Scott, you had a story to tell about Ring Around the Rosie. I thought that was amazing.
Yeah, thanks, Tom. I'm not sure of the exact details, but I was doing some reading that said that in the medieval times with the bubonic plague, that it would show in the form of like a red bump with a ring around an inflammation, the bubos, and that the children's song, Ring Around the Rosie, the first sign of disease, Pocket Full of Posies, was when the bodies were so prolific they'd be set out on the street and a wagon would come for pickup. And so to know someone that instead of someone sleeping versus someone that was dead, you'd put flowers in their pockets, both for the scent and to give a sign to the wagon.
Take this body away.
And then ashes, ashes, we all fall down, funeral pyres. So it's this kind of morbid children's song we've been singing for hundreds of years in reference to a massive disease.
And apparently the flu epidemic of the 1918s started not just in Kansas, but started in with a pig farm that was there in Kansas. On that military base.
Yeah, I believe it was on public broadcasting system TV. I recall that the soldiers from all around the nation came before deploying to Europe. They were all like didn't have all this exposure. And then at the same time, some of them for food, the soldiers were dedicated to the swine farm. And that apparently the swine flu of that time crossed over into the humans. And they became this ground zero for this, and apparently then many of them that were affected didn't die, but they went over, and then in the trench warfare, the wet and cold conditions, plus international troops from all over, became like an incubator, and then they returned and became the inoculate to the American population.
Right. And similarly, their peers, the populations of other countries. Thank you, Scott. And in fact, it makes sense. One of the big concerns is that the bird flu will not so the big concern is not so much that it's going to leap into humans, because from birds to humans is a bit of a stretch, but that it will leap into one of the animals that human eats, and pigs are the ones that are closest to us in many regards biologically. A lot of experiments, a lot of medical experimentation is done on pigs. In fact, I believe it was insulin that they used to get from pigs that before they started making it artificially to give to humans. There's a lot of biological similarities, oddly enough, between us and pigs. And that if this jumps into the pigs, then it's very easy, because now it's in a mammal. Birds are not mammals. They're farther. They're more distant from us in the animal kingdom. But if it jumps into a mammal, like a pig or a cow or something like that, then it can jump into us very easily, and then you got a big problem. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number, Michelle in Long Beach, California on the line. Hey, Michelle.
Hey, Tom. Hey, listen, you know, I wanted to make sure that you knew that you guys could sign up for an update, especially your listeners from that site. Lori Price will send you updates. The thing is,
that site being what?
LegitGov.org, that's I posted that in your room. The thing that when I read that about a month ago, I was reading into it. Tamiflu just helps with the symptoms,
right.
I believe.
It boosts the body's immunity in some way. So you know, it doesn't prevent you from getting the flu, but it prevents the flu from killing you.
Right, and in my search with the World Health Organization and I called because I just wanted to suggest that everyone, you know, search it out, get the information via the avian flu, you know, in like one of your searches to understand that really about the flu, the virus itself, when you're talking about it going into humans, my understanding and my reading is that it's like you said, not a likely happening unless it then goes into a mammal. However, their biggest scare is that this flu infects someone with the regular human influenza.
Right, and then those two flu viruses exchange genes.
Yep, and that would be uncontainable.
Right, and the odds of that happening right now are fairly low because there's not a lot of human flu virus running around right now. But this fall, the human flu virus, the H3N3 or whatever it is going to reemerge, as it always does in the fall. And then if you've got the H5N1 floating around, these two viruses infecting the same human being would produce that kind of mutation or could produce that kind of mutation.
Exactly, and that's, you know, my main reason for calling you is just to suggest that everyone educate themselves, not just listen to you, but go in there, do your research on it, understand what you need to do to take care of yourself, because as they say, if you're a healthy individual, right now, for you to contract such a disease, you have a better chance of fighting it with the Tamiflu.
Yeah, and, Tamiflu is gone. I mean, all the Tamiflu that's available for the United States for the next 2 years has already been sold to the wealthy few in the United States.
And if you do a search on that, also, you can look into buying it from Canada, although,
They're standing in line. The French got there first.
Right.
And then the Brits.
Right.
And between the two of them, they tied up 2 years' worth of production.
Right.
And the factory, of course, is in Switzerland, so I'm sure the Swiss, they don't have a large population. They probably actually got there before everybody else.
Right.
So, you know, I wonder if, you know, there's going to be a reemergence like there was in 1918 of all these home remedies. Used to know a guy who was very into, this was an early teacher of mine way back years ago, who said that, you know, if you get something like the flu, that what you do is you take the juice of a lemon and an equal amount of honey. So it's like, you know, maybe a quarter of a cup of lemon, freshly squeezed lemon juice, a quarter cup of honey, mix them together, and then take an entire bulb of garlic and press it, and you stir that garlic into that honey and lemon, and then every 2 hours you take a tablespoon of this stuff. We have used this for 30 years. We raised our kids with honey, lemon, garlic. You get a cold, you get the flu, it knocks it out. Turns out that there's a really powerful drug in that garlic called allicin, and there's vitamin C in the lemon, and somehow the sugar in the honey facilitates the transport of this stuff, you know, across the membranes. But, these kinds of things, or if they're more high-tech ones, like lactoferrin, you know, the milk derivative, it's very expensive. It was used early on before there were any drugs for AIDS by AIDS patients that activates the immune system. You know, whether these kinds of things are going to become hot properties, you know, the whole thing is fascinating. And again, I just have to say, and thank you, Michelle, for the call.
Oh, yeah. And, thank you, Tom.
You're welcome. And for pointing out that legitgov, legitgov.org, and they have the flu link on it. To me, the tragedy in all this is the failure, the absolute, utter, abject failure of this administration to do anything to plan for this in any way other than essentially militarily and police-wise. And, you know, it just tragically shows where our priorities are. Carol in Santa Cruz, California. Hey, Carol, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Thanks. I just wanted to tell you that I have a friend who's a doctor, and I think you call him immunologist. And he is on the Navajo Indian Reservation where he works with all kinds of things, including hantavirus and so forth. And 6 months ago, he told me to get all my family to get Tamiflu. He said the avian flu is coming. He said it'll be here within a year or two. And he said it's going to be a killer.
Were you able to get Tamiflu?
I didn't try, you know. Now, I didn't even realize that many people knew about it. Now I hear you.
Yeah, it's amazing. When that article in the Wall Street Journal first appeared, I have a friend who's a physician down in Florida, an old friend from college, and I sent him an email saying, Steve, any chance you'd write me a prescription for Tamiflu so I can just have this in my back pocket? And he was like, no, you got to go talk to your doctor about that. And I didn't follow through on it. And now I see that it's way too late, and, you know, it's...
Oh.
But I read the article in the Wall Street Journal. In fact, I talked about it on the air. I said, you know, this, the Wall Street Journal is telling the quote, investor class of America, end quote, that they should be buying Tamiflu. And you know, maybe we all should, but it's too late. It's too late for that.
Okay. Well, so, I just wanted to reaffirm what you were saying anyway.
Yeah. So apparently the docs know about it, even though.
Yeah, and this was 6 months ago.
Yeah, okay. Carol, thank you very much. In fact, that was 6 months ago, was about the time that article appeared. Oh, my, oh, my, oh, my. Well, let's move on. Chris, 1-866-889-8894. Chris in Salinas, California on the line. Hey, Chris, what's on your mind today?
Hey, how you doing? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm just really frustrated with what's going on with this Iraqi constitution and the compared to our constitution. I've read your book, What Jefferson Would Do, and your We the People.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, you know, how can George Bush stand there and say that we're doing this for democracy when this is going to be an Islamic state? And yet we don't see this or hear this in the media, that they're questioning this.
Well, you could argue that an Islamic state is democracy if that's what the majority of the people want. And, you know, it would be a cogent argument, just like you could argue that in Venezuela, even though, you know, you got Pat Roberts and all these guys saying that Hugo Chavez is a socialist, that it's really a democracy. The people said, hey, we would like you to use our oil money to provide us with free medical services and discounts on food for the poor. We would like that. And in fact, you know, some 85% of the people voted for him. He even won the plebiscite, the recall election. He beat that, you know, and it was observed by Jimmy Carter. That's democracy. So, you know, whether you end up with a government that some would call socialist, I wouldn't, or whether you end up with a government that some would call Islamic, And I would agree with that. If the majority of the people want it, then by some definitions, by most definitions, that is democracy. But the bigger question, I think, Chris, is whether it's worth the deaths of a couple of thousand of Americans and hundreds of billions of dollars in American treasure and the disfigurement of tens of thousands of Americans and the deaths of hundreds of thousands or at least 100,000 Iraqis. And the entire world hating the United States and the spread of terrorism, if that's worth having an Islamic Republic or even a democracy in Iraq. And frankly, I think the price is too high.
Yeah, maybe I'm more concerned with their rights, you know, as far as women's rights. I think maybe that's what I'm more concerned with is that they're going backwards for their people.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's not what we stand for, yet we're supposed to be spreading this, well, democracy or, you know, across the Arab countries, you know, that's our intention.
Yeah, good point, Chris. Thank you. Thanks.
Thanks.
Thanks for the call. Yeah, it's not just going backwards. I should agree with you. I should say it is going backwards, and it's worse than that. Here in the United States, you have all these cons who actually have been believing the story that Iraq and Afghanistan are the same thing. And that, I mean, we saw this woman, this Ann Coulter wannabe on TV a couple nights ago saying, oh, you know, in Iraq, before we invaded, all the women were in the burqa. They were wearing burqas and now they don't have to. No, Iraq was one of the most modern and most secular of all the republics in the Middle East, of all the Arab countries in the Middle East. Not of all the republics, of all the countries in the Middle East. That's not to say that it wasn't a country terrorized by Saddam Hussein and his sons, but, you know, pretty much it was the people who were involved in politics who were terrorized by them. Average working people could have their average jobs. You just couldn't hold a political opinion. Now, that's not to say that that's a good thing, but at least there was law and order, and women could go to school, and in fact did go to school. There was free public education. They could become doctors. They could work in the hospitals, and they did. They didn't have to wear the veil. They were wearing blue jeans. They could, you know, it was actually a very westernized culture. And because of our invasion and our occupation and the way that we have totally screwed this thing up, and probably more than anything else, the way that we imposed on them laws that said that any corporation can come in and do anything it wants, and we're giving $50 billion now to American contractors, to 150 American contractors, $50 billion, more than twice the gross domestic product of the entire country of Iraq. so that they can pay Americans to go in there for $150,000 a year and rebuild the country, which, by the way, they can't do. They have to wait in the green zone for the situation to stabilize, but we're paying them on the money anyway. You have a 50% unemployment rate in Iraq. I mean, this is just nuts. We should do it the way that we did with the Marshall Plan, where we go in and we say, okay, you've got companies here. We're gonna give some of the money to these companies, and then we're going to not only build roads in Germany and Japan and rebuild the war damage, but we're also going to help you build up your corporate infrastructure. We're going to build up your industrial infrastructure. You're going to end up with a good country. You're going to end up with a strong economy. Oh, but that's the way that liberal Harry Truman did it. Harry Truman, he gave those Europeans and those Japanese, those folks who lost in World War II, he made sure that they all had national health care, and he made sure that they all had strong unions, and he made sure that the money that was spent in their countries was actually going to companies in their countries so that it could be used to rebuild their countries. We're going to show him that the conservative way is the right way to do it. Screw the will of we the people. Forget about health care. Get rid of the unions. Ban them. Make them illegal. We're going to just let the corporations come in here and run the show, and they'll show you how to create a paradise, a conservative paradise. And sure enough, just like 25 years of conservative economics and conservative trade policies have devastated the United States, they're devastating the United Kingdom. They're starting seriously to harm Italy and France and Germany. They have wiped out Iraq economically. And thus, you get 50% of the people unemployed. What are they going to do? They're going to say, hey, get out of our country. We can do a better job ourselves. It's called an insurgency.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So love your
forgiven people dying, children hurt, pain, and crying. When you practice what you preach, won't you turn the other cheek? Father, 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 Father.
Welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you 5 minutes before the hour. Ruth writes, hi, Tom. I'm listening to your program today and was just about to send an email regarding my mother and her immediate family living through the 1918 epidemic. By the way, all of our ancestors, all of our parents lived through the 1918 epidemic, all of us. So we might have a little more immunity than we think. In any case, she says, my mom actually helped you see, if they hadn't lived through it, we wouldn't be here, right? Anyhow, my mom actually helped neighbors who eventually died with the flu and never came down with her herself. Her father, my grandfather, was from Germany and my grandmother from Austria, and they and the children wore a clove of garlic on a string around their necks so as not to get sick. I don't know what their diet was, but the garlic was what my mother always said she owed her life to. So, home remedies. Are we reduced to home remedies? Well, maybe. I mean, you know, what do we have? Jacob sends me a note. He says, replace the garlic with ginger and add a trace of gold as a catalyst, and you have a remedy that kept our family well for generations. So, our folk remedy show here today. It's all good stuff, in my opinion. I think that there's a lot of wisdom in trial and error. It's one of the best ways that human beings have figured things out over the years, and you get it that, you know, for generation after generation after generation, people have been using rose hips and ginger and garlic and to keep well, to keep healthy. Maybe there's something to it. Maybe. Anyhow, back to the whole thing in Iraq. I just wanted to wrap up with this this point. Russ Feingold, this, by the way, from the thinkprogress.org blog. Senator Russ Feingold, the Democrat from Wisconsin, big deal. Everybody was talking about it, how last week he said, you know, we ought to set a timetable for withdrawal. Now, what was it that provoked him to say that? This is what he said on Meet the Press last Sunday. He said, let me tell you about a conversation I had in the Green Zone with one of the top generals in Iraq when I was there with Senators Clinton and McCain. I said, off the record, your own view, would it help if we had a timeline to let the world know that we're not staying here forever? And this is what he said verbatim. He said, and this is Russ Feingold quoting the general, quote, nothing would take the wind out of the sails of the insurgents more than having a timeline in place. So the next time some con says, oh, yes, if we set up a timeline, then the insurgents will, that's going to give them inspiration and strength. No, I'm sorry. That's going to take the wind out of their sails, because an insurgency can only operate if it has the support of the people. And the people are only supporting the insurgents. They're only defending and hiding them, because they don't see an end in sight. And if we said, hey, we'll be out of there in 3 months, the people would stop defending the insurgents. I think this general is absolutely right. Nothing would take the wind out of the sails of the insurgency more than having a timeline in place. Absolutely true, in my humble opinion. Thanks for being with us this weekend. Thanks to Louise for producing our program, to Scott for engineering it, and Kareth and Louise and all the folks who have helped out. Thanks to the folks in our chat room. We'll see you next week, same time, same place.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.